Monday morning. Having, out of friendship for the family, upon whose estate, praised be heaven, I and mine have lived rent-free time out of mind, voluntarily undertaken to publish the memoirs of the Rackrent family, I think it my duty to say a few words, in the first place, concerning myself. My real name is Thoddy Quirk, though in the family I have always been known by no other than Honest Thoddy. Afterward, in the time of Sir Murtaugh, deceased, I remember to hear them calling me Old Thoddy, and now I've come to Poor Thoddy, for I wear a long greatcoat winter and summer, which is very handy, as I never put my arms into the sleeves, they are as good as new, though come Hollantied next I've had it these 7 years, it holds on by a single button round my neck, cloak fashion. The cloak, or mantle, as described by Thoddy, is of high antiquity. Spencer, in his view of the state of Ireland, proves that it is not, as some have imagined, peculiarly derived from the Scythians, but that most nations of the world anciently used the mantle, for the Jews used it, as you may read of Elias's mantle, etc., the Chaldees also used it, as you may read in Diodorus, the Egyptians likewise used it, as you may read in Herodotus, and may be gathered by the description of Berenice in the Greek commentary upon Callimachus, the Greeks also used it anciently, as appeared by Venus's mantle lined with stars, though afterward they changed the form thereof into their cloaks, called palla, as some of the Irish also use, and the ancient Latins and Romans used it, as you may read in Virgil, who was a great antiquary, that Evander, when Aeneas came to him at his feast, did entertain and feast him sitting on the ground, and lying on mantles, insomuch that he useth the very word mantle for a mantle. Humi Montilia sternit. So that it seemeth that the mantle was a general habit to most nations, and not proper to the Scythians only. Spencer knew the convenience of the said mantle, as housing, bedding, and clothing, Erin. Because the commodity doth not countervail the discommodity, for the inconveniences which thereby do arise are much more many, for it is a fit house for an outlaw, a meet bed for a rebel, and an apt cloak for a thief. First, the outlaw being, for his many crimes and villainies, banished from the towns and houses of honest men, and wandering in waste places, far from danger of law, maketh his mantle his house, and under it covereth himself from the wrath of heaven, from the offence of the earth, and from the sight of men. When it raineth, it is his penthouse, when it bloweth, it is his tent, when it freezeth, it is his tabernacle. In summer he can wear it loose, in winter he can wrap it close, at all times he can use it, never heavy, never cumbersome. Likewise for a rebel it is a serviceable, for in this war that he maketh, if at least it deserves the name of war, when he still flieth from his foe, and lurketh in the thick woods, this should be black bogs, and straight passages, waiting for advantages, it is his bed, yea, and almost his household stuff. To look at me, you would hardly think Poor Thoddy was the father of Attorney Quirk, he is a high gentleman, and never minds what Poor Thoddy says, and having better than 1500 a year, landed estate, looks down upon Honest Thoddy, but I wash my hands of his doings, and as I have lived so will I die, true and loyal to the family. The family of the Rackrents is, I am proud to say, one of the most ancient in the kingdom. Everybody knows this is not the old family name, which was O'Shaughlin, related to the kings of Ireland, but that was before my time. My grandfather was driver to the great Sir Patrick O'Shaughlin, and I heard him, when I was a boy, telling how the Castle Rackrent estate came to Sir Patrick. Sir Tallyho Rackrent was cousin german to him, and had a fine estate of his own, only never a gate upon it, it being his maxim that a car was the best gate. Poor gentleman! He lost a fine hunter in his life, at last, by it, all in one day's hunt. But I ought to bless that day, for the estate came straight into the family, upon one condition, which Sir Patrick O'Shaughlin at the time took sadly to heart, they say, but thought better of it afterwards, seeing how large a stake depended upon it, that he should, by act of Parliament, take and bear the surname and arms of Rackrent. Now it was that the world was to see what was in Sir Patrick. On coming into the estate he gave the finest entertainment ever was heard of in the country, not a man could stand after supper but Sir Patrick himself who could sit out the best man in Ireland, let alone the three kingdoms itself. He had his house, from one year's end to another, as full of company as ever it could hold, and fuller, for rather than be left out of the parties at Castle Rackrent, many gentlemen, and those men of the first consequence and landed estates in the country such as the O'Neills of Ballinagrady, and the Moneygalls of Mount Juliet's town, and O'Shannons of Newtown Tullyhog made it their choice, often and often, when there was no room to be had for love nor money, in long winter nights, to sleep in the chicken house, which Sir Patrick had fitted up for the purpose of accommodating his friends and the public in general, who honored him with their company unexpectedly at Castle Rackrent, and this went on I can tell you how long. The whole country rang with his praises. Long life to him. I'm sure I love to look upon his picture, now opposite to me, though I never saw him, he must have been a portly gentleman, his neck something short, and remarkable for the largest pimple on his nose, which, by his particular desire, is still extant in his picture, said to be a striking likeness, though taken when young. He is said also to be the inventor of raspberry whiskey, which is very likely, as nobody has ever appeared to dispute it with him, and as there still exists a broken punch bowl at Castle Rackrent, in the garret, with an inscription to that effect, a great curiosity. A few days before his death he was very merry, it being his honor's birthday, he called my grandfather and God bless him, to drink the company's health, and filled a bumper himself, but could not carry it to his head, on account of the great shake in his hand. On this he cast his joke, saying, "What would my poor father say to me if he was to pop out of the grave, and see me now? I remember when I was a little boy, the first bumper of claret he gave me after dinner, how he praised me for carrying it so steady to my mouth. Here's my thanks to him, a bumper toast." Then he fell to singing the favorite song he learned from his father for the last time. Poor gentleman, he sung it that night as loud and as hearty as ever, with a chorus. "He that goes to bed, and goes to bed sober, falls as the leaves do, falls as the leaves do, and dies in October, but he that goes to bed, and goes to bed mellow, lives as he ought to do, lives as he ought to do, and dies an honest fellow." Sir Patrick died that night, just as the company rose to drink his health with three cheers. He fell down in a sort of fit, and was carried off. They sat it out, and were surprised, on inquiry in the morning, to find that it was all over with poor Sir Patrick. Never did any gentleman live and die more beloved in the country by rich and poor. His funeral was such a one as was never known before or since in the county. All the gentlemen in the three counties were at it, far and near, how they flocked. My great-grandfather said, that to see all the women, even in their red cloaks, you would have taken them for the army drawn out. Then such a fine willa. You might have heard it to the farthest end of the county, and happy the man who could get but a sight of the hearse. But who'd have thought it? Just as all was going on right, through his own town they were passing, when the body was seized for dead, a rescue was apprehended from the mob, but the heir, who attended the funeral, was against that, for fear of consequences, seeing that those villains who came to serve acted under the disguise of the law. So, to be sure, the law must take its course, and little gain had the creditors for their pains. First and foremost, they had the curses of the country, and Sir Murtagh Rackrent, the new heir, in the next place, on account of this affront to the body, refused to pay a shilling of the debts, in which he was countenanced by all the best gentlemen of property, and others of his acquaintance, Sir Murtagh alleging in all companies that he all along meant to pay his father's debts of honor, but the moment the law was taken of him, there was an end of honor to be sure. It was whispered, but none but the enemies of the family believe it, that this was all a sham seizure to get quit of the debts which he had bound himself to pay in honor. It's a long time ago, there's no saying how it was, but this for certain, the new man did not take at all after the old gentleman. The cellars were never filled after his death, and no open house, or anything as it used to be, the tenants even were sent away without their whiskey. I was ashamed myself, and knew not what to say for the honor of the family, but I made the best of a bad case, and laid it all at my lady's door, for I did not like her anyhow, nor anybody else. She was of the family of the Skinflings, and a widow. It was a strange match for Sir Murtagh. The people in the country thought he demeaned himself greatly, but I said nothing, I knew how it was. Sir Murtagh was a great lawyer, and looked to the great Skinflint estate. There, however, he overshot himself, for though one of the co-heiresses, he was never the better for her, for she outlived him many's the long day he could not see that to be sure when he married her. I must say for her, she made him the best of wives, being a very notable, stirring woman, and looking close to everything. But I always suspected she had Scotch blood in her veins. Anything else I could have looked over in her, from a regard to the family. She was a strict observer, for self and servants, of Lent, and all fast days, but not holidays. One of the maids having fainted three times the last day of Lent, to keep soul and body together, we put a morsel of roast beef into her mouth, which came from Sir Murtagh's dinner, who never fasted, not he, but somehow or other it unfortunately reached my lady's ears, and the priest of the parish had a complaint made of it the next day, and the poor girl was forced, as soon as she could walk, to do penance for it, before she could get any peace or absolution, in the house or out of it. However, my lady was very charitable in her own way. She had a charity school for poor children, where they were taught to read and write gratis, and where they were kept well to spinning gratis for my lady in return, for she had always heaps of duty yarn from the tenants, and got all her household linen out of the estate from first to last, for after the spinning, the weavers on the estate took it in hand for nothing, Because of the looms my lady's interest could get from the linen board to distribute gratis. Then there was a bleach yard near us, and the tenant dare refuse my lady nothing, for fear of a lawsuit Sir Murtaugh kept hanging over him about the watercourse. With these ways of managing, 'tis surprising how cheap my lady got things done, and how proud she was of it. Her table the same way, kept for next to nothing duty fowls, and duty turkeys, and duty geese, came as fast as we could eat 'em, for my lady kept a sharp lookout, and knew to a tub of butter everything the tenants had, all round. They knew her way, and what with fear of driving for rent and Sir Murtaugh's lawsuits, they were kept in such good order, they never thought of coming near Castle Rackrent without a present of something or other, nothing too much or too little for my lady: eggs, honey, butter, meal, fish, game, grouse, and herrings, fresh or salt, all went for something. As for their young pigs, we had them, and the best bacon and hams they could make up, with all young chickens in spring, but they were a set of poor wretches, and we had nothing but misfortunes with them, always breaking and running away. This, Sir Murtaugh and my lady said, was all their former landlord Sir Patrick's fault, who let them all get the half year's rent into arrear. There was something in that to be sure. But Sir Murtaugh was as much the contrary way, for let alone making English tenants of them, every soul, he was always driving and driving, and pounding and pounding, and canting and canting, and replevying and replevying, and he made a good living of trespassing cattle. There was always some tenant's pig, or horse, or cow, or calf, or goose, trespassing, which was so great a gain to Sir Murtaugh, that he did not like to hear me talk of repairing fences. Then his Harriet's and duty work brought him in something, his turf was cut, his potatoes set and dug, his hay brought home, and, in short, all the work about his house done for nothing, for in all our leases there were strict clauses heavy with penalties, which Sir Murtaugh knew well how to enforce. So many days duty work of man and horse, from every tenant, he was to have, and had, every year, and when a man vexed him, why, the finest day he could pitch on, when the creature was getting in his own harvest, or thatching his cabin, Sir Murtaugh made it a principle to call upon him and his horse, so he taught him all, as he said, to know the law of landlord and tenant. As for law, I believe no man, dead or alive, ever loved it so well as Sir Murtaugh. He had once 16 suits pending at a time, and I never saw him so much himself. Roads, lanes, bogs, wells, ponds, eel wires, orchards, trees, tithes, vagrants, gravel pits, sand pits, dunghills, and nuisances, everything upon the face of the earth furnished him good matter for a suit. He used to boast that he had a lawsuit for every letter in the alphabet. How I used to wonder to see Sir Murtaugh in the midst of the papers in his office. Why, he could hardly turn about for them. I made bold to shrug my shoulders once in his presence, and thanked my stars I was not born a gentleman to so much toil and trouble, but Sir Murtaugh took me up short with his old proverb, learning is better than house or land. Out of 49 suits which he had, he never lost one but 17, the rest he gained with costs, double costs, treble costs sometimes, but even that did not pay. He was a very learned man in the law, and had the character of it, but how it was I can't tell. These suits that he carried cost him a power of money. In the end he sold some hundreds a year of the family estate, but he was a very learned man in the law, and I know nothing of the matter, except having a great regard for the family, and I could not help grieving when he sent me to post up notices of the sale of the fee simple of the lands and appurtenances of Timoleague. I know, honest thoughty, says he, to comfort me, what I'm about better than you do. I'm only selling to get the ready money wanting to carry on my suit with spirit with the Nugents of Carrickashaughlin. He was very sanguine about that suit with the Nugents of Carrickashaughlin. He could have gained it, they say, for certain, had it pleased heaven to have spared him to us, and it would have been at the least a plump 2,000 a year in his way, but things were ordered otherwise for the best to be sure. He dug up a fairy mount against my advice, and had no luck afterwards. These fairy mounts are called anthills in England. They are held in high reverence by the common people in Ireland. A gentleman, who in laying out his lawn had occasion to level one of these hillocks, could not prevail upon any of his laborers to begin the ominous work. He was obliged to take alloy from one of their reluctant hands, and began the attack himself. The laborers agreed that the vengeance of the fairies would fall upon the head of the presumptuous mortal who first disturbed them in their retreat. Though a learned man in the law, he was a little too incredulous in other matters. I warned him that I heard the very banshee that my grandfather heard under Sir Patrick's window a few days before his death. The banshee is a species of aristocratic fairy, who, in the shape of a little hideous old woman, has been known to appear, and heard to sing in a mournful supernatural voice under the windows of great houses, to warn the family that some of them are soon to die. In the last century, every great family in Ireland had a banshee, who attended regularly, but latterly their visits and songs have been discontinued. But Sir Murtagh thought nothing of the banshee, nor of his cough, with a spitting of blood, brought on, I understand, by catching cold in attending the courts, and overstraining his chest with making himself heard in one of his favorite causes. He was a great speaker with a powerful voice, but his last speech was not in the courts at all. He and my lady, though both of the same way of thinking in some things, and though she was as good a wife and great economist as you could see, and he the best of husbands, as to looking into his affairs, and making money for his family, yet I don't know how it was, they had a great deal of sparring and jarring between them. My lady had her privy purse, and she had her wee dashes, and her sealing money upon the signing of all the leases, with something to buy gloves besides, and, besides, again often took money from the tenants, if offered properly, to speak for them to Sir Murtagh about abatements and renewals. Now the wee dashes and the glove money he allowed her clear perquisites, though once when he saw her in a new gown saved out of the wee dashes, he told her to my face, for he could say a sharp thing, that she should not put on her weeds before her husband's death. But in a dispute about an abatement my lady would have the last word, and Sir Murtagh grew mad. I was within hearing of the door, and now I wish I had made bold to step in. He spoke so loud, the whole kitchen was out on the stairs. All on a sudden he stopped, and my lady too. Something has surely happened, thought I, and so it was, for Sir Murtagh in his passion broke a blood vessel, and all the law in the land could do nothing in that case. My lady sent for 5 physicians, but Sir Murtagh died, and was buried. She had a fine jointure settled upon her, and took herself away, to the great joy of the tenantry. I never said anything one way or the other whilst she was part of the family, but got up to see her go at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's a fine morning, honest thoughty, says she, goodbye to ye. And into the carriage she stepped, without a word more, good or bad, or even half a crown, but I made my bow, and stood to see her safe out of sight for the sake of the family. Then we were all bustle in the house, which made me keep out of the way, for I walk slow and hate a bustle, but the house was all hurry-scurry, preparing for my new master. Sir Murtagh, I forgot to notice, had no childer, this is the manner in which many of Thoughty's rank, and others in Ireland, formerly pronounced the word children, so the Rackrent estate went to his younger brother, a young dashing officer, who came amongst us before I knew for the life of me whereabouts I was, in a gig or some of them things, with another spark along with him, and led horses, and servants, and dogs, and scarce a place to put any Christian of them into, for my late lady had sent all the feather beds off before her, and blankets and household linen, down to the very knife cloths, on the cars to Dublin, which were all her own, lawfully paid for out of her own money. So the house was quite bare, and my young master, the moment ever he set foot in it out of his gig, thought all those things must come of themselves, I believe, for he never looked after anything at all, but harum-scarum called for everything as if we were conjurers, were he in a public house. For my part, I could not bestir myself anyhow, I had been so much used to my late master and mistress, all was upside down with me, and the new servants in the servants' hall were quite out of my way, I had nobody to talk to, and if it had not been for my pipe and tobacco, should, I verily believe, have broke my heart for poor Sir Murtagh. But one morning my new master caught a glimpse of me as I was looking at his horse's heels, in hopes of a word from him. "And is that old Thoughty?" says he, as he got into his gig. I loved him from that day to this, his voice was so like the family, and he threw me a guinea out of his waistcoat pocket, as he drew up the reins with the other hand, his horse rearing too. I thought I never set my eyes on a finer figure of a man, quite another sort from Sir Murtagh, though withal, to me, a family likeness. A fine life we should have led, had he stayed amongst us, God bless him. He valued a guinea as little as any man, money to him was no more than dirt, and his gentleman and groom, and all belonging to him, the same, but the sporting season over, he grew tired of the place, and having got down a great architect for the house, and an improver for the grounds, and seen their plans and elevations, he fixed a day for settling with the tenants, but went off in a whirlwind to town, just as some of them came into the yard in the morning. A circular letter came next post from the new agent, with news that the master was sailed for England, and he must remit all 500 to Bath for his use before a fortnight was at an end. Bad news still for the poor tenants, no change still for the better with them. Sir Kit Rackrent, my young master, left all to the agent, and though he had the spirit of a prince, and lived away to the honor of his country abroad, which I was proud to hear of, what were we the better for that at home? The agent was one of your middlemen, who grind the face of the poor, and can never bear a man with a hat upon his head. He ferreted the tenants out of their lives, Not a week without a call for money, drafts upon drafts from Sir Kit, but I laid it all to the fault of the agent, for, says I, what can Sir Kit do with so much cash, and he a single man? Middlemen. There was a class of men, termed middlemen, in Ireland, who took large farms on long leases from gentlemen of landed property, and let the land again in small portions to the poor, as under tenants, at exorbitant rents. The head landlord, as he was called, seldom saw his under tenants, but if he could not get the middleman to pay him his rent punctually, he went to his land, and drove the land for his rent, that is to say, he sent his steward, or bailiff, or driver, to the land to seize the cattle, hay, corn, flax, oats, or potatoes, belonging to the under tenants, and proceeded to sell these for his rents. It sometimes happened that these unfortunate tenants paid their rent twice over, once to the middleman, and once to the head landlord. The characteristics of a middleman were servility to his superiors and tyranny towards his inferiors. The poor detested this race of beings. In speaking to them, however, they always used the most abject language, and the most humble tone and posture, please your honor, and please your honor's honor, they knew must be repeated as a charm at the beginning and end of every equivocating, exculpatory, or supplicatory sentence, and they were much more alert in doffing their caps to those new men than to those of what they call good old families. A witty carpenter once termed these middlemen journeymen gentlemen. But still it went. Rents must be all paid up to the day, and afore, no allowance for improving tenants, no consideration for those who had built upon their farms. No sooner was a lease out, but the land was advertised to the highest bidder, all the old tenants turned out, when they spent their substance in the hope and trust of a renewal from the landlord. All was now let at the highest penny to a parcel of poor wretches, who meant to run away, and did so, after taking two crops out of the ground. Then finding down the year's rent came into fashion, anything for the ready penny, and with all this in presence to the agent and the driver, there was no such thing as standing it. I said nothing, for I had a regard for the family, but I walked about thinking if his honor Sir Kit knew all this, it would go hard with him but he'd see us righted. Not that I had anything for my own share to complain of, for the agent was always very civil to me when he came down into the country, and took a great deal of notice of my son Jason. Jason Quirk, though he be my son, I must say was a good scholar from his birth, and a very cute lad. I thought to make him a priest, but he did better for himself, seeing how he was as good a clerk as any in the county. The agent gave him his rent accounts to copy, which he did first of all for the pleasure of obliging the gentleman, and would take nothing at all for his trouble, but was always proud to serve the family. By and by a good farm bounding us to the east fell into his honor's hands, and my son put in a proposal for it. Why shouldn't he, as well as another? The proposals all went over to the master at the Bath, who knowing no more of the land than the child unborn, only having once been out a-grousing on it before he went to England, and the value of lands, as the agent informed him, falling every year in Ireland, his honor wrote over in all haste a bit of a letter, saying he left it all to the agent, and that he must let it as well as he could to the best bidder, to be sure and send him over L200 by return of post. With this the agent gave me a hint, and I spoke a good word for my son, and gave out in the country that nobody need bid against us. So his proposal was just the thing, and he a good tenant, and he got a promise of an abatement in the rent after the first year, for advancing the half year's rent at signing the lease, which was wanting to complete the agent's L200 by the return of the post, with all which my master wrote back he was well satisfied. About this time we learned from the agent, as a great secret, how the money went so fast, and the reason of the thick coming of the master's drafts. He was a little too fond of play, and Bath, they say, was no place for no young man of his fortune, where there were so many of his own countrymen, too, hunting him up and down, day and night, who had nothing to lose. At last, at Christmas, the agent rode over to stop the drafts, for he could raise no more money on bond or mortgage, or from the tenants, or anyhow, nor had he any more to lend himself, and desired at the same time to decline the agency for the future, wishing Sir Kit his health and happiness, and the compliments of the season, for I saw the letter before ever it was sealed, when my son copied it. When the answer came there was a new turn in affairs, and the agent was turned out, and my son Jason, who had corresponded privately with his honor occasionally on business, was forthwith desired by his honor to take the accounts into his own hands, and look them over, till further orders. It was a very spirited letter to be sure. Sir Kit sent his service, and the compliments of the season, in return to the agent,